and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The basic rights of the American people have been destroyed by a new Supreme Court ruling. This should be a warning sign to every person in the United States. The police can now illegally stop, detain, search, and arrest you or any other person as long as they or you have an outstanding warrant or even an unpaid parking ticket. Goodbye, democracy. Hello, police state. An organized rebellion broke out against President Obama in the State Department last week when 51 officials leaked a dissenting memo that demands airstrikes against the Syrian government. Not ISIL, not Daesh, not the Islamic State, but against the Syrian government. A new corruption scandal in Brazil could implicate one-third of the country's lawmakers, bringing the coup government of Michel Temer to its knees. But first, we turn to the Supreme Court ruling on police powers. We are joined in studio by Eugene Perrier. He is a core organizer with the Stop Police Terror Project. And by phone from Washington, D.C., by Mara Verheiden-Hilliard. She is the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Welcome, Mara and Eugene.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Mara, I want to start with you. Sonia Sotomayor, the Supreme Court Justice, issued an eloquent, perhaps historic, dissent against the Supreme Court ruling. And I want to read a couple sentences from it and then ask you to comment. This is the justice, her dissent. The court today holds that the discovery of a warrant for an unpaid parking ticket will forgive a police officer's violation of your Fourth Amendment rights. Do not be soothed by the opinion's technical language. This case allows the police to stop you on the street, demand your identification, and check it for outstanding traffic warrants, even if you are doing nothing wrong. Is this really true? Could the courts have made such a sweeping ruling?
Well, Justice Sotomayor issued, as you said, a really stunning, eloquent, significant dissent today in a ruling that does just as she said it does. And the ruling came down in the case Utah v. Streif, in which a police officer conducted a stop of someone without reasonable suspicion, ran a warrant check, found that they had a warrant, then searched an outstanding warrant, searched the person based on that, and found a small amount of drugs on the person, then arresting them for that. And under decades of Supreme Court jurisprudence, there has been established what's called the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, that if the police stop you and it's an illegal stop and they find something, then they can't use what they find against you. And the reason that this exists in our society is so that the police don't have an incentive to go out and just conduct wholesale mass illegal stops all over the country. Once the Supreme Court cuts this back, they've said and they've given a green light to the police that if you conduct an illegal stop, a fishing expedition, and you find something, or more critically, you find that someone has an outstanding warrant, and then you find something, then you are justified and the illegal stop doesn't matter anymore. And as Justice Sotomayor pointed out, there are 7.8 million Americans with outstanding warrants. And we know that in communities of color, in Black and Latino communities, that the figure proportionally is astronomical. The Justice Department itself found that in Ferguson, that there were 16,000 outstanding warrants among 21,000 people.
Amazing. So 16,000 warrants, and some of these, or most of those, are very, very, very minor. In other words, not because people have done something terribly wrong. Perhaps they didn't pay a ticket. Perhaps they didn't pay a fine. But those people, so I want to help the audience just understand how this plays out. Mara. So the police stop you in Ferguson, Missouri, or anywhere, for instance. They might not have a reason, a probable cause, a suspicion that you've committed a crime, but they stop you and say, we want your identification. They get the identification. They run a quick check on you. It turns out you have a warrant. You have an unpaid parking ticket. Now they can search your car. They can search your apartment. They can do whatever. And if they do, even though the stop was illegal, not with probable cause, and they find something, now they have a legal basis to arrest you. That's really what we're talking about. And that means the whole idea of probable cause, the whole idea of the Fourth Amendment to stop the government from having unfettered sort of search and seizure rights against the population, all of that sort of disappears now.
The standard for this kind of stop is reasonable suspicion. So you have kind of three ways that people can interact with the police, or the police can interact with the civilian population. And one is that they can do just a sort of an investigative questioning stop, but you have the right to walk away. You have the right to not answer questions. You have the right to turn and leave. The second is reasonable suspicion and what's called a Terry stop. And under those circumstances, the police have to have reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed, is being committed, or is about to be committed. And those are the circumstances in which they can then detain you for further investigation. And that's what's happened here, is they're saying that there wasn't reasonable suspicion. It was an illegal stop. The third, of course, is an arrest. And that's a, you know, full-on custodial detention and arrest. So, in fact, what they've told the police is you can go ahead, you can illegally stop someone, you can demand information from them because they're not free to leave. And then if that information leads to a warrant, then you're good.
Or it leads to the revelation that a warrant exists, that there's an outstanding warrant or an unpaid parking ticket or something like that.
Right. I mean, the police routinely do warrant checks. So they stop people and they run their information, they call it in, and they do warrant checks. And the warrant checks are, as you're saying, not because there's a warrant out because someone's, you know, necessarily on the lam for some major crime. Warrants are often, people often don't even know that they have a warrant out. And it is for unpaid traffic tickets, minor misdemeanor offenses, just a range of things.
Eugene Perrier, you are one of the organizers of the Stop Police Terror Project in Washington, D.C. You're also the author of a book about mass incarceration that has developed during the last 30 years, especially 2.3 million people, I believe, are in American prisons. The U.S. has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the prisoners in the world are here, right in the United States, in the free world. I want to go back to Sonia Sotomayor's dissent and read it to you and then ask you to comment on it. She writes, it's highly personal in a way, but of course it has universality for especially people in African American and Latino communities. She writes, quote, "Black and brown parents have given their children the talk, instructing them never to run down the street. Always keep your hands where they can be seen. Do not even think of talking back to a stranger, all out of fear of how an officer with a gun will react to them." Eugene, some people will read this and say that's an exaggeration, but it's true though, isn't it? All the African-American parents have that talk with their kids. Your parents had it with you, probably.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's obviously true. This has been, it's been a major issue since the Trayvon Martin situation in terms of the broader media discourse. Certainly that's if folks remember when John Derbyshire from the National Review was fired for mocking this issue. But the reality is, in a situation where there are thousands and thousands of people who are killed by the police who are mostly black and brown people and never held responsible, there is a situation where black people in this country have to, and Latino people as well, and Native people as well, have to adopt or oftentimes choose to adopt a posture that is designed to defend themselves from being seen as some sort of person that can in some way be construed as criminal, and that thus their killing, arrest, imprisonment, whatever, can all be justified. So I think that Sonia Sotomayor is really just calling it on the carpet here, and certainly it's in a dissent. It reminds someone of Justice Murphy's dissent in the Korematsu case, calling out racism, and I think that sometimes we see these pop up in these Supreme Court decisions. But I would say, you know, bravo to the justice for saying what is, you know, really unambiguously true.
Yeah. Mara, Sonia Sotomayor, the justice who wrote the dissent, I want to read again because her dissent is so important, I think. I want to read another piece from it and then ask you to comment on it. "This case tells everyone, white and black, guilty and innocent, that an officer can verify your legal status at any time. It says that your body is subject to invasion while courts excuse the violation of your rights. It implies that you are not a citizen of democracy, but the subject of a carceral state just waiting to be cataloged." I mean, powerful, eloquent words.
One of the reasons that it reads the way that it does, is she is responding to Justice Thomas's opinion, in which he and the other justices who joined with him were trying to minimize to the public the import of what they had done. And they actually wrote that in this case, the police officer, and in like cases, the police officer had not engaged in anything that would be considered bad faith, that it was negligence at best, and that there was no evidence of systemic or recurrent police misconduct under these circumstances, which is an amazing thing to be writing about in the United States at this point in time when the Black Lives Matter movement has put these issues front and center, that you would have five justices on the Supreme Court. And I know one of those justices was Justice Breyer, who joined with the majority in this case and who was appointed by Bill Clinton in 1994. He joined with the majority in this appalling opinion. But that you would have all these justices really downplaying the conduct of the police and basically saying, we're just going to give the police the benefit of the doubt and this incredible ability to violate people's rights.
And Mara, just a quick follow-up question on that. Breyer formed the 5-3 majority, of course. Scalia is dead. He is no more. And so the court lost one of its most vociferous and vocal right-wing advocates, ultra-right-wing, perhaps racist, certainly pro-cop in all things. But Justice Breyer then he was the one who made it a majority. If he had not voted with the majority, if he had not voted with Clarence Thomas, if this Clinton appointee had not voted with Clarence Thomas and John Roberts and the other right-wingers, then what would have happened? Because this was coming off of an appeal court decision that said that the original stop and arrest by the police officer was in fact illegal. In other words, if they had had even a tie vote here, this law would not have become law. I mean, this ruling would not have had the impact that it does.
Well, that's correct. The case had last been heard at the Utah Supreme Court, which had thrown out the evidence as fruit of the poisonous tree. And by Justice Breyer joining with Thomas, joining with Alito, joining with Roberts, joining with Kennedy, by the Clinton appointee joining the right wing of the court on this issue, he made the 5-3 majority that now has created this new line of jurisprudence into people's fundamental Fourth Amendment rights.
Eugene Pernier. So let's go back. We have a Clinton appointee, Breyer, who becomes with the right-wing judges, the basis for the 5-3 majority, eviscerating the rights of individuals in the United States, and especially, as Sonia Sotomayor pointed out, Black and brown rights, the people in Black and brown communities who are the most affected by police misconduct, systematic police conduct. Because let's go back to what Judge Clarence Thomas actually wrote in the majority opinion. He said, Officer Fockrell, this was the police officer in the original case, was at most negligent. That's what Mara had said. There is no evidence that Officer Fockrell's illegal stop of this individual reflected flagrantly unlawful police misconduct, just negligence. I mean, you part of the Stop Police Terror Project. It's systematic, the misconduct. It's not, I mean, the justices know. They know that this isn't incidental. It's not accidental. It's systematic.
Oh, I mean, it's obviously systematic. I mean, you know, you look at the issue of the Freddie Gray trial going on right now in Baltimore, where they're debating this as if maybe it never happened. I mean, you know, they've actually, since 1997, the police in Baltimore have killed a person and paralyzed a person using a rough ride. You've had several officers actually testify that they didn't do what they were supposed to do in terms of belting the guy in. And then you had the guy driving around giving a rough ride. And yet and still, somehow it's still up in the air. The reality is that systematic police misconduct is consistently just swept under the rug as negligence or, you know, the cost of doing business or whatever it may be. But here's the bottom line on this case. Mass incarceration inside of the United States of America is a military solution to a social problem. The idea that they will not do anything to help the most distressed and oppressed communities in this country. The Black Lives Matter movement has brought this unbelievable occupation-style policing to the forefront of the society. People in large numbers have objected to that. So ultimately, what is happening in our society is we're seeing through the Supreme Court decision, changes in, you know, small changes in how the police are operating in laws, in attempt to shift the frame from mass incarceration purely in terms of the sentencing and things like that to turning society itself into more of a prison using this so-called you know, smart policing techniques, trying to target things and use GPS tracking and expanding the ability to search. So even though they'll be imprisoning less people, the basic logic of the system of occupation style policing doesn't change, because they're not going to do anything, they being the government or the corporations, to rebuild these communities, lift people out of poverty and solve their problems. And so they can't change their model of social control. And I think that's what's really behind this ruling.
Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, we have about 2 minutes left. You're with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. You defend people and alert the public to the dangers from the evisceration of basic individual rights, the rights to privacy, the right to gather, the right to be free from unreasonable police stops like now, which has been codified by the new Supreme Court decision. Even if this is targeting certain communities more, particularly Black and Latino communities, what does it say about the status of the Bill of Rights? I mean, basic core rights going forward. How big of a danger, how big of a threat is this?
Well, one need only look at what's been brought to light with the Black Lives Matter movement and even just the statistics in the United States. I mean, you have 65 million Americans who have arrest records. And that means, as Sotomayor pointed out in her dissent, that anytime you try and get a job, get housing, anything that involves a background check, and an arrest record exists even if you were innocent, you have an arrest record. You know, that people end up with their lives completely stifled and curtailed in their ability to function. And this is something that is now going to be increased with the police ability to conduct these kind of stops. And it's an amazing shift when the civil rights movement fought so hard and civil liberties advocates and people in the streets fought so hard to have a fundamental understanding of your Fourth Amendment right to be free from illegal search and seizure. And now the court is saying to the American people, well, actually, you can have an illegal stop, and then we're going to authorize the search and seizure.
Okay, amazing. We're going to come back to this subject. Very big, has historic importance, I would say, for civil liberties, civil rights in the United States going forward. We've been talking with Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. She is the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund here in Washington, D.C., and by Eugene Puryear, a core organizer with the Stop Police Terror Project. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Will Hillary Clinton accelerate the drive for regime change in Syria if she becomes president? A mutiny in the State Department broke out or was revealed last week against President Obama's Syria policy as 51 State Department officials signed a dissenting memo that calls for airstrikes against the Damascus government as a means to defeat ISIL, or so-called Daesh, or Islamic State. But would this bring a greater war in Syria, with Russia, with Iran? We are joined by Daniel McAdams again. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Welcome back, Daniel.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me back.
So, internal document, a way for State Department officials to criticize the existing status quo, I guess, a policy that began where State Department internal memorandum of these type could be produced. I guess it started back in the Vietnam War. But I want to read part of it. We call for the judicious use of standoff and air weapons that would undergird and drive a more focused and hard-nosed U.S.-led diplomatic process. I mean, what is a judicious use of standoff and air weapons?
Well, Brian, I think you need a neocon decoder ring to be able to understand that in actual English. But by definition, sending missiles to a country that hasn't attacked you against a civilian population is the definition of extrajudicial killing. There's nothing judicious about sending missiles, so it's a funny use of term. But the thing about this letter, a couple of very curious things about this letter. First of all, it is only 51 out of about 13,000 Foreign Service officers and Foreign Service specialists. So indeed, the dissent channel is the appropriate. This is not the prevailing view. But how interesting that it was sent to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. It was leaked to them with the understanding that the names of the signatories would remain classified. So we have no idea who these people are, just that they've run this up the flagpole. So as you correctly pointed out, and actually, as Phil Giraldi mentioned in today's piece on UNS.com, this is an application letter to join the Hillary Clinton foreign policy team.
Exactly. Because Hillary Clinton, as we know, while Secretary of State in the first Obama president term, the first 4 years, I mean, she really was the hawk. She was the one demanding war against Libya. Even Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, who had been President Obama's Secretary of Defense, President Obama held him over, historically a Republican. He was like making the case that Libya falls outside of U.S. strategic interests, as, or what I believe he said. In other words, he was trying to put brakes on a possible full-scale war against Libya. But it was Hillary Clinton who really demanded the war. She and the Washington Post were pillorying Obama as being the, quote, passive president, because he, too, seemed to be offering restraint. Hillary Clinton really is the neocon, liberal hawk. Maybe the two are identical, but it would be her policy and it would be somewhat different than Obama's policy.
You know, ironically, it's in this case, at least, and I think it's been the case in the past, it's the Pentagon that actually has to fight these wars that has been reticent to dive into this. And it's the State Department, which is not involved in fighting and winning these wars, that's particularly hawkish. And I think you do have kind of a Trojan horse of neocons that have come into the State Department. And I don't know if you read Robert Perry of ConsortiumNews.com, but he's, I think, terrific. And he has a great piece a few days ago tracing the history of how the neocons have infiltrated the State Department, starting with Reagan and certainly through Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and how they've made their claim. And I think this is one of the reasons why you don't see any names associated with this. But I'll tell you what, Brian, this has the fingerprints of Victoria Nuland all over it. And Robert Ford, by the way, former U.S. ambassador to Syria, who could be credited or discredited from starting this whole bloody nonsense in the first place.
Right. And is there an intersection between the so-called traditional liberal hawks and the neoconservatives? Because Hillary Clinton doesn't come from the neoconservative movement. Certainly her husband does not either. But in terms of their policies, you take what happened in Yugoslavia, both in 1995, the all-out war, the bombing campaign of Serbia and Kosovo, which of course was part of Serbia in 1999, the decision in 1998 to make regime change rather than weapons control the priority in Iraq. And that, while of course Clinton did not lead the out-and-out invasion, George W. Bush did that in Iraq, it sort of set the stage. The neocons and the traditional liberal hawks, they almost seem to be one and the same grouping, hyper-interventionists.
Yeah, and I think they both base foreign policy on an ideological outlook on the world, which is that the world should and can be remade by force, that the United States is an exceptional nation and therefore shoulders the historic responsibility of forcing other countries, whether they like it or not, to do something that Washington thinks will be in their best interest. They have different ways of describing these interventions. They may say this is for humanitarian reasons, or they may even say this is for realpolitik reasons. But in fact, neither the two of them are realists or idealists. They're very strongly ideologues, and that is always a danger, I think. And, you know, the proof is in the outcome of the policy. From Yugoslavia on, you've seen nothing but bad outcomes to these interventions.
Yeah, we're talking to Daniel McAdams about the 51 individuals who signed a letter. And Daniel, you said there were 13,000 State Department employees, I think. So 51 is a small number, but it got a lot of media attention. 51 people who said in an internal dissent channel that President Obama's policy in Syria was wrong, that there should be the judicious use of missiles to strike Syrian targets, not ISIL targets, the Syrian government targets, the Syrian Arab army targets. In other words, the army that has done the bulk of the fighting and dying to defeat ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Al-Nusra, or the Army of Conquest, the other terrorist organizations. These people in the State Department who, according to you, Daniel McAdams, may have written a job application for Hillary Clinton's next State Department, they want to step things up. But here we have an election. Hillary Clinton's on the one side. You have Donald Trump on the other. Trump is an odd candidate, to say the least, obviously. But in his xenophobia, his racism, his ban Muslims, build a wall at the Mexican border, all of these odious policies. But on international affairs, he has been castigating the war in Iraq, saying the war against Libya and Gaddafi was a bad idea, that it would be better for Gaddafi to remain in power. He wasn't that keen on the Syrian civil war, and he's for better, he says, relations with Russia. And Hillary Clinton said about Donald Trump, he has a bizarre fascination with dictators and strongmen. And then she said, I will leave it to the psychiatrist to explain his affection for tyrants. Now, that sounds kind of like a good campaign line, but the tyrants she's talking about, the ones he says he has, she says he has an affection for, that would be Saddam Hussein in Iraq, or Putin in Russia, or Gaddafi in Libya, or Assad in Syria. These are the places that Clinton actually wants to go to war against.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I think a lot of people are attracted to Hillary Clinton because of the possibility of an historic first woman president, you know, and it signifies great progress, according to these people. But what's interesting is the places where she wants to have conflict and where she successfully had U.S. invasions. Look at the treatment of women after the so-called liberation. Look what's happened to women in Syria, in parts of the country that are occupied by Nusra or ISIS. They're forced to cover up. They're forced to, you know, to obey this sort of male-dominated society. And that just simply was not the case in secular Syria under the, quote, dictator Assad. So if you're really looking out for women's issues, you think that you'd back off on policies like bombing Assad, which would allow the rise of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which have a horrific record when it comes to treating women, of course, but all people, all human beings.
One thing about the letter of the 51 State Department officials that seems to, it doesn't even seem to come into play, but it must come into play, is the question of the constitutionality. I mean, it's just, these guys are saying, these men and women are saying, you know, let's have a judicious use of missiles against Syria. In other words, bombing a country that the United States, as you said, is at peace with Syria. Syria has not attacked the United States. It's not menacing the United States. It's not demanding things from the United States that would be of a menacing character. But the Constitution of the United States says war can only be enshrined. It can only be made legal when the U.S. Congress declares it. And now, because the U.S. Congress hasn't declared a war since the beginning of World War II, it seems as if that part of the Constitution just doesn't matter. So could this be legal? Is this a legal sort of document where somebody says, hey, let's go bomb another country that the United States is at peace with?
Even the rhetoric of the administration, look what Kerry said, was it last year, you know, in the 21st century, you don't just go bombing another country on a phony pretext.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what unfortunately has been happening and what these people are encouraging even more of. There's no way it's legal to do this. There's also no way that you can justify this under the 2001 authorization for the use of force, even as flawed as that whole idea was. It's simply untrue that Syria was attacking the U.S. in 2001 or had anything to do with 9/11. So you could never justify certainly attacking the Syrian government on the basis of the 2001 authorization. It doesn't seem like any of these rational arguments work on people like this. And I wonder, maybe I'm having a fantasy, but I'd like to at least imagine that the State Department at one time held people that were intelligent and understood diplomacy and studied the sort of the greats in diplomatic history. And now it just seems to be populated by ideologues.
Last week, Russian planes in Syria launched airstrikes on armed rebel groups in Syria who have been armed and trained by the United States to overthrow first the Assad government. The U.S. says they're now fighting ISIL, too. John Kerry said about the Russian bombing of these armed groups, Russia needs to understand that our patience is not infinite. Okay, that's Kerry saying to Russia, warning Russia, speaking tough with Russia, our patience is not infinite. Why is it that the United States government feels that it has the right? And what are its geostrategic, or what is the Obama administration's geostrategic goals in arming, providing weapons and money to any of the armed opposition groups that are fighting to topple the secular and sovereign government in Damascus?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of U.S. policy in the Middle East is driven by U.S.'s so-called allies. You have the Saudi Arabia and Turkey. You have the Gulf states. You have Israel. They all want to get rid of secular Assad for a variety of different reasons. And there doesn't seem to be any adults in the room who would step back and say, well, what's actually in the best interest of the United States? Instead, you have these various pressure groups with lots of money that they throw around in Washington. And they're determined to get what they want. But by what right does the U.S. decide that a country has to go or be overthrown? You know, look at the ignoble role of Robert Ford, the U.S. ambassador there, who's now been back in the media. He had a big interview in the New Yorker where he says, oh, back then in 2012, we had no idea that that what we were doing might result in al-Qaeda being in Syria. It's a total lie because we all know in mid-2012, the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, had an assessment that said this is exactly what will happen if the U.S. continues down this path. And Ambassador Ford said, we never were for overthrow. We were for negotiation. But recently it's come out that some of the people that participated in those early talks with Ford from the opposition said, no, that's not true. You told us from the beginning that Assad has to go. So this is you have these sort of players like Robert Ford and others who are taking things into their own hand, and it's undermining U.S. security.
And we know from those of us who are outside the White House protesting against the possible beginning of a major U.S. military operation against Syria, again, not against ISIL, against the Syrian Arab Army, the government-led army. That was back in August and September 2013 when John Kerry said Syria had crossed the red line, that Syria had used chemical weapons, and thus that would be the triggering event for a major U.S. bombing campaign against Syria. We remember then that there was no talk at all about ISIL. There was no talk about the danger, the existential danger posed by the so-called Islamic State or the other terrorist groups. All of the propaganda from the American side was directed only and exclusively against the Assad government. Now, of course, that they thought after Libya that Assad would fall, but Assad has not fallen. And Assad, I don't think, will fall because the government not only has a popular base of support, of course they have many enemies, but they have a popular base of support. They have allies in Iran, they have allies in the Hezbollah forces, and they have allies in Russia. And Russia has entered and said, we feel that the Syrian government must be a part of the solution to the problem of defeating ISIL. And they're not going to fall as a consequence. So what happens with U.S. policy, say Hillary Clinton, who presumes to be the president of the United States? I mean, what could she actually do under these circumstances in Syria? Are we at a new danger stage? We have about 90 seconds left, Daniel.
Okay. I think the plan B that's emerging that may well come to pass under a Clinton, maybe even a Trump administration, who knows, but most likely under Clinton, would be to simply disintegrate the country, and leave Assad in charge, but in charge of nothing. You split up the Kurdish regions, you push the Kurds to take more territory, you split out the East, you split and cut and slice and turn it into essentially an ungovernable Libya-style country with Assad in charge of, parts of Damascus. And that would be an absolute tragedy for all of the religious and ethnic minorities and every decent human being who'll be stuck in a real hellhole. Yeah, thanks a lot, Washington.
Yeah, I think you're right, Daniel McAdams. That's what goes under the rubric of federalization, but it's actually the very severe internationally organized partition, division of Syria. We saw how that played out in Yugoslavia. We see how it's played out in Libya. And of course, Iraq today is in fragments, a terrible, terrible tragedy for the people of the region, the people of those countries. We've been joined by Daniel McAdams. He's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Thanks again, Daniel. We hope you'll come back soon. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. A new corruption scandal in Brazil could implicate one-third of the country's lawmakers as the coup government of Michel Temer struggles to create any kind of legitimacy. What does this mean for the impeached President Dilma Rousseff? We are joined by Kim Ives. He's a contributor to the publication Haiti Liberté and in the studio by Brazilian activist and research fellow at the Center for Hemispheric Affairs, Aline Piva. Welcome, Aline and Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Let's talk, if we could, about what's actually happening right now. We had very, very, very corrupt politicians impeaching Dilma Rousseff, who's not corrupt, certainly not corrupt personally, but who may have finagled with the numbers on a budget, something that many governments do to sort of make up deficits or to cover the budget. But they've impeached her. She's on the sideline. She's out. Michel Temer, her vice president, who's part of a kind of, I would say, a vast right-wing conspiracy to overthrow the existing Workers' Party government, is the current government. But that government seems to be now almost completely overwhelmed by new corruption scandals of its own. Kim or Aline, whichever one of you wants to jump in, sort of summarize what's happening between Brazil's Odebrecht and the OAS construction multinationals with Leo Pinheiro, who are trying to organize plea deals that could implicate, I think, 30% of the lawmakers. Talk about it, if you would.
Okay, so recently, the president of OAS, Leo Pinheiro, he implicated José Serra, the minister of foreign affairs appointed by Michel Temer, in the corruption scheme involved Petrobras. Serra is one in a list of nearly 100 politicians that the president of OAS claims to be involved in this scheme, but he hasn't revealed all the names yet. It is also very likely that Serra will be implicated in Odebrecht's plea bargain deals, since he appeared on another list of more than 200 politicians that was obtained in a search made at the home of one of Odebrecht's executives. Other key figures of the opposition have appeared in those lists, such as Aécio Neves, who lost last presidential election to Dilma Rousseff.
Kim Ives, talk about it. I mean, it's quite an amazing situation about what's going on in Brazil. We have the Olympics coming up. We have all sorts of social and economic problems, much of which flows from the economic crisis created not in Brazil, but on Wall Street in 2007, 2008. The Workers' Party government, Dilma Rousseff-led government, won the last election, and they've won four consecutive elections. They won with 52% of the vote in 2014. Yet they're on the outs, but the current coup government that demanded their ouster on the basis that the Workers' Party was corrupt now seems to be maybe falling itself. Talk about it.
Well, again, as we said the last time I was on your show, Brian, this is part me of the U.S. Assault on the BRICS. Brazil is, of course, the B in BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And I think we've seen under the Obama regime the perfection of these soft power coups. The first one, of course, was Zelaya in Honduras. It was, again, the parliament who gave him the coup, but, you know, he was dragged out of his bed in the middle of the night in his pajamas and dumped across the border. This is maybe slightly more refined, but it may be years before we know the full story. But we can kind of see the markers, if you will, of the U.S. hand. Particularly by the position taken by the OAS, the Organization of American States, which Cuba calls Washington's Ministry of Colonial Affairs, which has made a point of going after Venezuela, which we know the U.S. enmity towards Venezuela, but has said nothing about what's happened in Brazil. And so their quiet acquiescence to it, to me, is really a part of the signature of the U.S. Backing to this effort. And I think it's going a little off the rails because, as Aline has pointed out, it is the very wolves who are guarding the chicken house, and it's coming back around to bite them. It's quite clear that they are the ones who are the most deeply steeped in corruption.
Guarding the chicken house, the fox or the wolves, Aline, the legal defendants of Marcelo Odebrecht told the press Sunday that their client had already agreed to participate in a deal, this is over the corruption case, a plea deal that would implicate over 175 deputies and senators of the 594 currently serving in the National Congress. When you talk about the people in Brazil, the masses of people who have probably all kinds of different political opinions and opinions on the efficacy of the Dilma Rousseff government, on the issue of corruption, there's obviously political divergences as well. But when you see that the coup government, the Temer government, may be brought down with 175 deputies being implicated in a plea deal for their own criminal corruption, how does it affect the masses of people?
Recent polls shows that over 67% of Brazilians has a negative evaluation of the government. Temer has, his personal approval is less than 10% right now. So everybody's, the feeling is that they were, people who were pro the impeachment, the feeling is that they were misleaded to the process. Also, they have made clear, Temer's government have made clear that their intentions is to stop the corruption investigations since day one. One of his first actions as president was to dismantle the CGU, which is one of the most important branches of the government in the corruption investigations. Many of his ministers are involved. People are taking the streets, but the things are still unclear on how things will unfold.
Yeah, if there was another election, and of course there's scheduled to be another election in 2018, if Lula ran for office again, and he could, unless he's now somehow arrested by the Temer government, the coup government, or unless charges are brought. In other words, unless he's sidelined somehow, under these circumstances, Lula is still the most powerful or popular politician. He would likely be reelected to be president, no?
Exactly. This same poll showed that on the scenarios that were proposed in this poll, Lula would win all the scenarios. So this is a very good point. And coming back to the plea bargain deal of Léo Pinheiro, he was negotiating with the prosecutors his plea bargain deal, and the process was stopped when he cleared Lula of two of the accusations that they were trying to push on Lula. So this makes very clear on what we have been saying since the beginning. Yes, there is a corruption scheme that has been investigated. But the whole point, the main point of it, is to derail all possibility of Lula being back in power in 2018 and to dismantle the nationalist project that was being implemented by the Workers' Party.
Kim Ives, that's very interesting that, you know, if we look at what the real goal is of the coup makers, their obvious first goal is to shield themselves from any sort of corruption investigation. In other words, if Dilma Rousseff's government was allowing the investigation of corrupt politicians to go forward, one way to stop the investigation is to have her impeached. So that's one objective. The other objective seems to be to make sure that Lula, who's more popular, the most popular political figure and the founder of the Workers' Party, who could run again for president in 2018, may not be able to run only if he was somehow ensnared by the coup makers in some sort of charge himself. It's not like 1964 where the military took over. It wasn't a soft coup. They just extinguished or exterminated the left. Now they have to discredit the left or ensnare it in legal maneuvers, as you were mentioning. And then there's the overall sort of global geostrategic politics in the region. And that's, Kim Ives, what you were talking about, that this doesn't happen simply within an insular domestic Brazilian context, but it is within the context of Latin America, and it has a global impact because, as you said, Brazil is part of the BRICS, the counter-hegemonic sort of formation. But talk about Latin America. Okay, soft coup, not hard coup, but we have, as you mentioned, Honduras, Argentina, Paraguay. What's happening in Venezuela, where now there are food riots that are being reported, that the government has been economically destabilized. The Maduro government says that it's the target of economic warfare by the elites within Venezuela. And, of course, all of it behind the scenes backed by the United States.
Well, it's interesting because Haiti is often sort of the groundbreaker in Latin America, the first revolution. In fact, it was Haiti that allowed Simon Bolivar to carry out revolutions on the continent. It was the first one to sort of foil U.S. election engineering in 1990 with the election of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. But it was also kind of the first soft coup that we saw. That was the 2004 coup against Aristide's second administration. And it's ironic now because they used Brazilian troops to occupy the Haiti after that coup. And now the irony is that now Brazil is getting paid back for their naivete in dealing with the U.S. in that coup. But it was very similar. They had this sort of iconic leader who was almost unassailable, Aristide, in power, and they basically would take down the people around him. They really study it and get the soft spots in the regime. And so I think, as you suggest, their real goal is to destroy the prestige, destroy the power of the Workers' Party, which has become really the vehicle for the tremendous advances Brazil has made over these past decade and a half of Workers' Party power, and find a way to discredit the face of it, who is in essence Lula. So to me, all of this is a part of, and it should be noted that the coup against Aristide was a Republican coup that was under George W. Bush. These are now under Obama. So this is a bipartisan thing. This single party with two heads that we have in this country really has a sort of continuity in the way it carries out these soft coups. And we've been seeing them again throughout Latin America. We saw it with Lugo in Paraguay. We saw it with Zelaya in Honduras. And now we're seeing it in Brazil with Dilma and Lula.
Alina Piva, I want to go back to what's going on inside Brazil, because we're talking about the regional politics, the global politics, but of course there's the domestic politics, how it actually plays out, how this drama plays out inside of Brazil. How is acting President Michel Temer involved directly in the scandal?
Okay, so unlike the elected president, Dilma Rousseff, Michel Temer, he has been cited as a direct beneficiary of the corruption scheme in Petrobras. Léo Pinheiro, for example, he said that he paid over $1 million in briberies to Temer. Still yet to be proven, but he was cited, directly cited.
And this is the individual who's trying to make the plea deal. So he's saying Michel Temer, who's involved in the Petrobras, the oil state-owned oil company scandals, he was bribed by him for $1 million. Keep going.
Exactly. So there are proofs that dating back to 1996 that Temer has been receiving briberies for doing contracts, public contracts, overbilled public contracts and getting kickbacks for those contracts. Other than that, I think it is very, very important to mention that in last May, Temer was found guilty of electoral fraud, and he is unelectable for running for office for 8 years.
So the current acting president, Michel Temer, who helped organize the coup and then replaced Dilma Rousseff during the coup, because of his own conviction on fraud, he cannot actually run for office for 8 years. But he's the acting president. And he became the president not because of an election, which he can't run for, but because he ousted or helped oust Dilma Rousseff, who was elected.
Exactly. And this is another point that is interesting and goes with what Kim was saying. This agenda, this new liberal agenda that he's trying to impose now in Brazil and that Macri is trying to do in Argentina and Paraguay. This is an agenda, a political agenda that hasn't been gaining popular support for many years now. So this soft coup, in a way, is exactly this. What you can, if you can gain power through democratic means to impose this new liberal agenda again, that in roll back social policies and denationalize all the oil or mineral exploitation that we nationalized in the past 2 decades, that's the way they're doing things. And again, wildly corrupted, couldn't get through democratic means. So
it's really quite amazing. You have, I'm so glad you brought that out, Alina, because it's not just about politicians shielding themselves from corruption charges, making sure that they don't go to jail. But the neoliberal policies, which mean drive down wages, make more unemployment, deregulate government services, privatize them, those are not popular policies. And so they can't win at the ballot box. The Workers' Party, which has led this project to build and develop social and economic reforms, not revolutionary government, but it's a progressive government. They've done it because they've been elected to do it. And the coup makers can't get elected. Their policies can't be supported. And why would they? Because they hurt poor people. They were working people, which is, of course, the majority of the population. Well, that's all the time we have. We want to thank Alina Piva and also Kim Ives. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.